Thanks, Alistair. Thanks, Jill. Good morning. Before I get started this morning, I'm just going to have a time of prayer, and we're just going to bless our fathers and our dads who are here today, those who aren't here today. These days always bring up a lot, sometimes good, sometimes less good things. So before I launch into today, I just want to have a time of prayer together. So would you bow your heads with me? Today, on this day that we call Father's Day, Jesus, we invite you in. Invite you, Lord, to bless. Bless the dads that are here. Equip them for what is before them. Equip them for the responsibilities that they have, the weight that they carry. We ask that you're near the dads that are here and the ones that aren't. The ones that aren't here because of distance, perhaps they've passed on. Ones who aren't near to us because there's some brokenness there. There's some broken relationship there. I invite you into all of it. We ask that you increase our wisdom, increase the wisdom of the dads who are here. That they would remember that as they turn to you, you will fill them up. You will give them wisdom when they feel they don't know what's next. And where there's a gap where dad should be, Lord, that you fill that too. Thank you, Jesus, for fathers. Thank you for the way, God, that you want to father us and shepherd us in a good way. Amen. All right. There we go. It's really great to be up here to share with you guys again. As usual, I'm speaking on something that I am no expert in, and so I'm preaching to myself too this morning. So let's see what we can learn together. Working as a counselor, I get to see and hear a lot of stories. And I get to hear about the events that have shaped people's behaviors, about the hurts that they carry, and the hopes that they're scared to say out loud. Part of my job is helping people to see unhealthy patterns, areas where they keep falling into the same ways of reacting, the same ways of coping, ways that are no longer helping them live the kind of life or be the kind of person that they want to be. And there are many unhelpful patterns of behavior that I see and that we all fall into. Many of our behaviors are helpful and make sense in the short term, but end up causing us a lot of pain in the long term. And there's one behavior in particular that's really interesting to me. And it's especially common or rising in the younger adults and teens that I work with. And it's the practice of quickly cutting people out of their life. This could be by ghosting their friends, not replying to texts any longer, blocking them on all social media, the equivalent of screening their phone calls or not replying to emails anymore, suddenly avoiding a coworker at the office, pretending not to see them at the grocery store. Essentially, pretending someone no longer exists if there's been a disagreement. You get the idea. To clarify, before I really get into this morning, I'm not talking negatively about cutting off or distancing ourselves from people when a separation is needed. For instance, if someone is trying to start over and make sober friends, there's a distance that's needed there from old friends and old habits. I'm not talking about finding non-abusive partners and changing your community to be healthier. I'm not talking about the need to put up healthy boundaries when there's manipulative family members or friends. I'm talking about the practice of disposing of friendships or coworkers or acquaintances anytime there's a disagreement or a difficult interaction. When we decide that anyone who makes us feel some way, whether it's offended or angry or stupid or weak, the false belief that the only option is to stop talking to that person, to at best pretend they no longer exist, and at worst try and get others to also cut them off, to show that they're on our side. A pretty quick way for me to assess how well someone is doing, how adjusted they are into adulthood, how equipped they are with useful life skills, is to count how many people they've stopped talking to due to a perceived offense or a slight without making any effort to work through it. I know people who can tell me everywhere they've ever gone who they no longer speak to. This morning, I want to discuss reconciliation. What it means for you and me to mend broken bridges. How those of us who are trying to follow Jesus' way can move toward what needs healing rather than simply walking away from relationships that have become strained or awkward or damaged. To attempt to make peace where there is animosity or indifference, both with other Jesus followers and in our greater communities. Jesus was teaching in Matthew 5, starting at verse 21. I'm not sure if I got my slides together. You've heard that our ancestors were told, you must not murder. If you commit murder, you're subject to judgment. We could all agree to that. But I say, if you're even angry with someone, you're subject to judgment. If you call someone an idiot, or whatever the culturally relevant term was when this was written, you're in danger of being brought before the court. And if you curse someone, you're in danger of the fires of hell. So, if you're presenting a sacrifice at the altar in the temple, and you suddenly remember that someone has something against you, leave your sacrifice there at the altar. Go and be reconciled to that person. And then come and offer your sacrifice to God. There's so much here. Jesus is talking about someone who is being a good follower of God. They're following the rules. They're bringing their sacrifice. They're going to temple. They're asking for atonement. God, I'm doing what you asked. And Jesus says, I don't want it. If you know someone has something against you, your priority is to be reconciled to the real people and community around you, and then come. Then I would love to hear what you have for me. I would love to see your religious practice. And that's hard. Jesus cared about us living and working toward reconciliation. Being reconciled, though, is a skill we have to practice within our homes, our churches, with our neighbors, our coworkers. The more young people I see who have no capacity to disagree well, whose only skill for coping with somebody offending them is to cut them off and stop speaking to them, really worries me. And our kids and our colleagues and our friends need to see a better way modeled. Or we're only going to become more fragmented and disconnected as the years pass, losing our ability to disagree well. We'll become like those who wonder why everyone else is so messed up. Everywhere I go, everyone's crazy. We leave behind us a wake of people that we used to have relationships with and the bitterness that comes with it. And we eventually stop seeing our role in what's left twisted behind us. Jer Swigert is the founder of an organization called Global Immerse. And he explores intersections of faith, leadership, peacemaking. And on the Where We Belong podcast earlier this month, he stated that, I think we're going to have it up there, hooray. Christians should be the world leaders at reconciliation. We should be the best on the planet at bridging difference into relationship with others, irritants, and enemies, recognizing that the one we claim to follow was the only one who took us beyond convenient understandings of neighbor love to enemy love. There's a lot there. I'm gonna give you a second because I need a drink. I'm trying not to cough right into the mic for you guys. Christians should be the world's leaders at reconciliation. Swigert's referring here, of course, to the parable of the Good Samaritan, where Jesus shifts the crowd's understanding of the old command to love your neighbor as yourself. It's so much more than your literal neighbor, although actually, if it was only about our literal neighbor, many of us wouldn't even be able to do that. To Jesus, loving our neighbor meant loving all, even enemies. Not just those we easily get along, we easily get along with, but those who are very different. Even those who have animosity toward you, who want harm for you. Again, in Matthew 5, Jesus states, starting at verse 43, "You've heard that the law says, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say, love your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you. In that way, you will be acting as true children of your Father in heaven. For he gives his sunlight to both the evil and the good. And he sends rain on the just and the unjust alike. If you love only who loves you, what reward is there for that? Even corrupt tax collectors do that much. If you're kind only to your friends, how are you different from anyone else? Even pagans, those who don't claim to follow God, do that." If we're not left convicted by passages like these, I'm pretty worried about our ability to see ourselves, to see the unhealthy ways that we think about others who are difficult in our lives, the ways we behave toward one another when we have an argument, even just in traffic. Jesus doesn't give us a lot of wiggle room in these passages for who we can decide it's okay to be awful to. This is what Christ asks of us. This is the way that we who are trying to follow Jesus are asked to live, and this is really hard. As humans, we want to belong, and we want to find people that we fit with, and we often organize ourselves naturally into groups based on who we are, who we aren't, and we can fall into wanting our friends to always agree with us and to disapprove of what we disapprove of, disapprove of who we disapprove of. We want to put distance between ourselves and them, whoever they are. Maybe they raise their kids a little differently than we do, or they work in jobs that are different than ours, or they have more money than we do, or they don't have as much as we do, or their family's really loud, or they're just really shy, or they're really proud, I don't want to be around them, or they're just really messy, their kids are really difficult, or their kids are way too perfect. I don't like that colleague because of how they act at work, so they don't deserve my respect. You get the picture. In the previous quote I read by Jer Swigert, he says that Christians should be the best on the planet at bridging difference. This is rarely what we're known for. As I was writing this, I was reminded of a line from an old hymn. "They will know we are Christians by our love, by our love. They will know we are Christians by our love." We've been talking the last month or so about how painful and excluded many actually feel from Christian love. My mom shared an interesting story with me recently about the power of mending rifts from our past. She was telling me about two really close family friends of ours. We'll call them Frank and Bill. Frank long ago took his business away from Bill. They were friends, they knew each other. It was noticed when he did so. Frank did this because he was upset about the rumors he was hearing about the way that Bill had started to run his business, about how he was treating his staff. Bill noticed that Frank, who he thought was a good acquaintance of his, stopped being a client, and he emailed and he reached out and said, "Frank, can we meet for coffee? I've noticed you've left, and I'd like to figure out what's going on here." Frank was upset at Bill and didn't even reply to the email or follow up in any way. And they stopped speaking. Both of these men profess to follow Jesus. They go to church regularly. In fact, Frank works in conflict resolution. And yet he ignored Bill's attempts to meet up and have what would be a tough conversation. Years passed since the relationship and the business went separate ways. Now, Frank recently took ill, very ill, actually. And he was asking my mom, how could our family still have relationship with Bill? After all, he's heard about him. And my mom explained that the growth we've seen in Bill over the years, how he sought out wisdom, how he sought out mentorship, how there was good there alongside the parts that are still hard to love. After hearing my mom's side of things, Frank, lying in a hospital bed, asked my mom to please text Bill for him. He said, "Can you ask Bill if he'll still meet me for coffee, the one he offered me so many years ago?" Frank knew what was in his heart and that his decision to take his business from Bill was about something much larger. He was convicted of the judgment he still felt he righteously carried toward Bill, his role in cutting him out of his life. So my mom sent the text message. Immediately, like within minutes, Bill texted my mom back. And he said, "Frank, there are tears in my eyes as I read this message. I would love to meet for coffee once you're well enough, and I look forward to it." There's power in offering reconciliation, in reaching out, in trying to mend that what's been broken, even if we once felt justified in ending the relationship. Now, does coffee mean that Frank and Bill will see eye to eye on everything? No. But both men will be able to say that they tried. And an awkward peacemaking is certainly better than a permanently turned back. It's easier in the short term to avoid those we have difficulty with. Way easier. I am just as prone to it as everybody else. But in the long term, it can leave us barely able to leave home without running into somebody that we have a bad history with, somebody that we're hoping won't notice us out in the community. And this behavior leads us to believe that we have it right and everyone else has it wrong, and we slowly lose our capacity, not just for major disagreements, but for even small inconveniences with others. We can begin to avoid certain people and places until our social circle is made up of only those who look, talk, and act exactly like us. Or worse, we force those around us to pretend that they agree with us because they know what will happen if we don't. Ephesians 4, verse 2 encourages us to always be humble and gentle. Be patient with each other, making allowance for each other's faults because of your love. We're not asked to pretend that no one has faults. That's not what I'm talking about. But to find room for them. To find room for people who are just too much for us. To remember that to some people, we are too much. And our faults are too hard for them to ignore. If I've shared this story before, forgive me. But I know the power of obeying Jesus' direction to be people who reconcile, the power of really small acts of reaching out. I was talking to a friend who was telling me a story of an old friend she had recently reconnected with. It had been a broken relationship, and they had been mending things, and it was really powerful. So I listened to that, and I thought, well, that's very nice for you. And did a bit of a check-in with myself, and God put a name on my heart really quickly. Someone I hadn't thought of in years, someone I hadn't seen in over 15 years, someone from high school. And I was like, oh, right, yeah, we weren't great. We weren't awful to each other, but she was well aware that I wasn't a fan of hers, and it was just awkward between us. I was not gracious toward her. I did not have space for her in my life. I put up with her. Probably that's the nicest way I could say. So that's fine. I was like, okay, Lord, you're right. I wasn't appropriate. I apologize. Please forgive me. This is all in theory. This person's in Winnipeg. I don't know what's happening to their life. But then 2 weeks later, I went to church with my parents in Winnipeg, and this family sits a few rows in front of us, and who is it? The girl that I have to apologize to, apparently. I was really annoyed because I knew what I had to do, and it was just not going to be fun, and it was going to be awkward, and there's other people in the room, and I didn't know how she'd react. But I actually pulled her out of the service because it was a communion service, and the scripture reminding us not even to take communion when we are at odds with another came to mind, so I felt really convicted to just grab her right there. So I pulled her out of the service, and she thought I was crazy, and I just apologized, and I said, I'm really sorry for how I treated you. And you know I wasn't fair to you, and I'm sorry that I made you feel like you were too much, because you're not. And that was really it. Later that day, she found me through other friends and sent me a long message telling me the journey that she had been on since high school, how she'd fallen into addiction because everywhere she went, she felt like she was too much for people. People didn't know what to do with her. They didn't know how to handle her. They didn't know how to make space for her. So she started drinking. At the time that I ran into her, she'd been sober for a number of years, and her family were doing really well. And she just thanked me. I needed to hear that. I needed to know that God has me on this journey. I needed to know that I'm not too much. Are me and this person best friends now? No. Are we at peace in each other's presence when we run into each other, when I go to church with my family? Yeah. Paul wrote in Romans 12, bless those who persecute you. Don't curse them. Pray that God will bless them. Be happy with those who are happy. Weep with those who weep. Live in harmony with each other. Don't be too proud to enjoy the company of ordinary people. Don't think you know it all. Never pay back evil with more evil. Do things in such a way that everyone can see you are honorable. Do all that you can to live in peace with everyone. Do all that you can to live in peace with everyone. Reconciliation with one another isn't easy, and not everyone that I am at odds with is even interested in living at peace with me. But we're only responsible for our own actions. I'm responsible to do all that I can to live in peace with others. And it will require humility and vulnerability and action, unfortunately, on our part. Humility because I need to be really clear-eyed about the role that I have played in a relationship breakdown or how I handled a disagreement. It's very easy to find ways to blame others for my poor behavior, to blame my coworker for deserving that treatment because they're just really hard to work with, to blame my neighbor for the way that I greet them on the street because they haven't been a very good neighbor and so I deserve to treat them this way. But I'm not responsible for anyone else, and neither are you. I'm responsible for my response, though, to others. I'm responsible for my role in either widening the gap between us or shrinking it. I don't always react well in conflict, in case you think that that's what I'm trying to say today. I'm human and I don't naturally move toward those I don't see eye to eye with, but it starts with approaching others with humility, being clear that I'm not always easy to be around either. It doesn't mean that we let others walk all over us either, or that we have to make sure everyone likes us. It means I have to pay attention to where I have justified avoiding what needs facing, where I've openly torn down instead of building up. It's not very fun, but it is important. It will also require that we're vulnerable. In my previous story about Frank and Bill, Frank put himself out there reinitiating contact with Bill. Bill could have ignored this peace offering. After all, Bill tried this years ago, and Frank rejected his offer. He could have pretended it was unnecessary, that nothing had happened, knowing that there was something that had happened, and it did still hurt. Guess what? Not everyone wants to live at peace with you. There may be folks who want to hold on to a grudge, thank you very much, and who are not ready to forgive you, or are simply not interested in fixing the relationship. And that's fine. That is on them. You are responsible for you, and I am responsible for me. Even now, if there's someone that you know you need to reach out to, really do pray and ask for courage to do it in a good way, a humble way, accepting the risk that they might not be ready, that they might not want to reconcile. It's a vulnerable thing when we reach out. Lastly, and maybe the most annoying part, is it takes action. It doesn't just happen. Reconciliation isn't waiting long enough that you both feel comfortable just not talking about it anymore. The things that have happened and not been reconciled stay as barriers between us, and they rob us of peace within ourselves and amongst others. Finding common ground is not me convincing you of how I was right all along. It's not me justifying my poor behavior to you until you agree, oh, I didn't do anything that bad, actually. It's looking for a place in the middle to meet, a place to offer each other grace, of coming together to look at and mend what's broken instead of just hoping it will rebuild itself. Back to Ephesians 4. I'm starting at verse 1 now. Therefore I, a prisoner for serving the Lord, beg you to lead a life worthy of your calling, for you have been called by God. Always be humble and gentle. Be patient with each other, making allowance for each other's faults because of your love. Make every effort to keep yourselves united in the Spirit, binding yourselves together with peace. I don't have to convince you that living at peace with one another is difficult. We can barely live at peace with the people under our own roof, the people nearest to us. But I know also that many of you have stories of the grace it is to be offered an olive branch, of how much better it feels to be reconciled than to harbor bitterness. I'm talking mostly today about interpersonal reconciliation, one-to-one. It applies to family, old friends, coworkers. I'm not sure if you have to make amends with anyone, and I'm not here to tell you that you do. It also applies, though, to our systems, our churches. Christians often pick sides and theologies. It's why there's so many churches and denominations and expressions of faith. It's also worth noting that it's National Indigenous Peoples Day this week. There's volumes written on the church's role and responsibility in reconciling there. We'll get more into that in September during Truth and Reconciliation Week. I'll leave you with one last story. I am the oldest of three kids in my family. My sister is the youngest, and she's 3 years younger than me. We did not get along growing up. We were and are very different. For every rule I wanted to follow, she wanted to break it. For every room I wanted to enter quietly, she wanted to loudly run in. For every church youth group night I attended, she was at some party lying about where she was. She wanted to make her own mistakes and not have to apologize for it, and I wanted to avoid making any mistakes if possible. By the time we were 18 and 15, we could barely speak to each other. I'm not exaggerating when I say that. It was very bad. Our relationship was horribly broken. She accused me of being judgmental, trying to be her mom, and I thought she was careless and hurting our parents and herself with her choices. But right around this time, for some reason, I knew I was actually responsible for reconciling with her. I was older. I had a bit more perspective. So as I left for Bible school, I was flying to New Zealand shortly after I finished high school. She was just starting high school. I was overcome with this urge and urgency to fix our relationship. There was enough that had happened. I knew time would not be enough. I wrote her a note about how I cared for her and the good things I wanted for her before I flew away. I reached out more often to check on her, and once home, I worked really hard to diffuse arguments that started. I worked hard to apologize whenever I was again sucked into a really dumb argument. She didn't trust my actions at first. She was on guard and ready to defend herself whenever I came near her to say anything. I had to bite my tongue when she made choices I didn't understand, and I had to realize that there was more than one way to live. And I didn't have it all together either. It happened really slowly, but over months and years, we learned how to be together peacefully, to look for the strengths in the other instead of the differences. It's easy to find the differences. We chose to believe the best about each other, and we learned to find our middle ground. When my sister got married, she asked me to be her maid of honor. During the speech at the reception, I told the crowd, "You all may think it's very normal that the sister is the maid of honor, but let me tell you how much work it took to get here." It was a result of a lot of hard work, of moving toward one another instead of away, of humbly trying to piece back together what was broken, because what was good, what was common, was worth fighting for. I promise that having the relationship with my sister today was worth all the effort it took to rebuild, the humility it required, the vulnerability, the repetitive action it took to convince her I meant it. We're still really different, and we live really different lives, but that's okay. Our efforts to reconcile with others will not always be welcomed, but I know that not trying will leave us with bitterness and regret. So I don't know this morning, maybe this is, you're sitting there thinking, this is not for me. Okay. But I don't know if there's someone that needs your forgiveness or somebody that you need to ask to forgive you. But I know that if we say we love Jesus, Scripture is really clear that our posture should be that of moving toward reconciliation, of being humble and vulnerable and active participants in making broken things whole, or at least patched up a bit better than they are. It's not easy work, but it is worthy work in our increasingly divided world. I'm going to close us just with Micah 6, verse 8. "This is what he, the Lord, requires of you. Do what's right, love mercy, and walk humbly with your God." Thanks for your time.